Welcome in to Locked On Knicks. A little bit of a bittersweet episode for me. I was starting to think, Alex, that Harvey Araton was our third co-host, but this is his fourth and final appearance, at least for the time being. He's a new book coming out next year. I'm sure we will talk to him for that. Harvey formerly wrote for the New York Post, the New York Times, still writes for the New York Times on a slightly part-time basis. Again, has a new book coming out soon. But most importantly, for our purposes today, the author of When the Garden Was Eden, and Alex, we end on a high with him.
Yeah, we finish our discussion of the 1970 and 73 championship teams and sort of the mystique of that era. We sort of come more towards the present, though, in this episode to finish things off, sort of wrapping up our large discussion with Harvey. First, talking about when he got to visit Clyde Frazier in St. Croix and get a look behind the mask sort of with Clyde and see, you know, the more personal toned down side of Clyde rather than the persona. Then we talk about whether James Dolan could have been a better owner in the 60s and 70s. Old Knicks owner Ned Irish was actually a pretty crazy guy himself and somehow managed to win a couple championships. So we talk about whether, you know, James Dolan maybe would have been better suited for a time when money talked a little more. And then finally, we end with the role of sports in tough times like these and like they were in the late 60s, early 70s in the U.S. and New York. And, you know, just kind of the vacuum that we're experiencing right now during this coronavirus crisis. Get Harvey's take on all that. And he had a nice, thoughtful answer to end the episode. So all that is in this episode. Be sure to check it out and also check out the other parts if you haven't already. We have three other parts of this posted. So, but we'll be back to finish our discussion with Harvey next.
You are Locked On Knicks, your daily New York Knicks podcast, part of the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.
This is all rebound, back up, off the glass, it's good! RJ brings the Knicks to the ball.
What he does is contagious.
Oh, Robinson with a catch and slam. Across the lane. Knox foul from behind. Count it and one to Trier. Trier drives. Oh!
Becomes infectious. Becomes infectious.
And then I guess to kind of flip to the other great star on that team, what was it like for you getting to go to St. Croix to interview Clyde? And I mean, maybe that's the wrong term to use the nickname, because I think it seemed like you got a feel for Walt Frazier, the human being and the duality of the perception of him, which was like this big partier, playboy, stylish guy. And I mean, in reality, he would duck out of clubs. He'd go home early. He'd eat granola. He'd go to bed. He'd sort of get ready for the next day's game. And I think it's pretty incredible to think about it, because he's just for our podcast listeners and for me and Alex, he's still this object of great fascination. He's had such a long life with the team, and it's still sort of hard to get to like which one is the real version of him.
Well, I think in his day, you know, he was a very prideful athlete who always was into health foods and you know, Butch Beard in the book tells the hilarious story of when he came to the Knicks in the mid to later 70s, when Walt was still on the team before he was traded to Cleveland, that they went out to dinner in Chicago one night and Walt brought just a little bag or something and pulled out all these ingredients and kind of made his own salad in a restaurant. And Butch is sitting there saying,
this is so great,
you know? And he said, you know, if I pulled that shit, they would have thrown my ass out of there.
Yeah.
But it was Walt Frazier, and he was known to do eccentric things like that. So he brought his own ingredients to make his own salad in the restaurant. But Walt was in, you know, Butch told me that Walt, back in those days, taught him yoga to stretch as he was an aging athlete to keep his body toned. So Walt was always kind of like a, you know, a a sort of a new age kind of guy. And he certainly, you know, I don't think he was going to ever, you know, claim that he'd slept with 20,000 women like Wilt, but he certainly got around. But, you know, as he aged, you know, there's certain realities of getting older set in. And so I think the point I was trying to make, certainly, you know, it was more obvious to me when I went to St. Croix and saw him. He pulled up to pick me up at the airport, this little airport in like, you know, jeans or white, I think like white painter's pants and a t-shirt and a baseball cap and sneakers. And that's the way he dresses on the island. You know, he has this whole different persona there. And, you know, I think, you know, when we see him on the telecasts, still wearing his loud suits, you know, I think the way I described it in the book was sort of like, you know, it's sort of like him, you know, it's like Leonard Nimoy putting on his Spock ears,
yeah,
playing a character that he, you know, that he's known for from his youthful days. I think that's who Walt is when you see him on TV, but he's not that person anymore. You know, he pretty much describes himself as a shut-in. You know, he has his restaurant, which he makes an appearance in once in a while. But, you know, Walt is 70-something years old, I suppose, at this point. And still looks remarkably good for a man his age. But, you know, he's not really Clyde anymore and hasn't been for a long time. But there, you know, there were, I think in those days, the other thing is that about most people who know Walt well will tell you that he's not really an extrovert and that he created the Clyde character that he would sort of slip into to, you know, to help promote himself as a brand. I mean, he was one of the first guys with a shoe deal. It was not a national shoe deal, but it was more of a regional, the Puma Clydes. But, you know, that wasn't who he was quite. He wasn't naturally an extrovert, but he understood that he was a good-looking man. He liked women, and he was playing in New York, and that he needed some kind of image. He didn't name himself Clyde the way LeBron James labeled himself the King, or what's the other one that that jumps out at me, that Kobe nicknamed himself the Black Mamba.
Yeah.
But, you know, I think it was Danny Whalen, because Clyde, you know, Walt liked to get those wide brim hats. And that was about the time when the movie Bonnie and Clyde came out. And he walked into the locker room one day and Danny Whalen, who had a sharp tongue, said, "Get a load of Clyde." You know, and somehow it stuck. But he played up to it. You know, he understood. He had a knack for self-promotion in a quiet, you know, clever kind of way. And you know, it stuck with him, you know, lifelong.
Guys, if you're anything like me during a pandemic, one of your bigger concerns is supporting your local restaurants, whether it's a restaurant you've loved your whole life, or you maybe picked up a few weeks before this all got started. But you want to make sure they're still there to serve you once this is all over. And one of the best ways to do that is by ordering delivery with the Postmates app. Postmates doesn't just deliver burgers and sushi. They actually make your life easier by doing grocery delivery and whatever you can think of delivery. Convenience stores, clothing stores, you name it. So you don't have to go out and get it. You can have someone do it for you. It's really, really easy to use. All you have to do is download Postmates on iOS or Android. You can find your favorites and get anything you want delivered within the hour. For a limited time, this is the key part, guys, Postmates is giving our listeners $100 of free delivery credit for your first 7 days to start your free deliveries. Deliver the app and use code LOCKEDONNBA. That's code LOCKEDONNBA for $100 of free delivery. No minimum purchase for your first 7 days when you download the Postmates app. Anything you need, anytime you need it, Postmate it.
So moving on from Clyde, another thing that really struck me in the book, and you made the comparison even at one point, was when I was reading about Ned Irish, who I was never really familiar with, because you only hear about the good parts of those title teams by and large. You know, you don't hear about what the owner was like. The only thing that was important was that they won a couple championships, and you know, that's always the most important thing and what gets remembered. But the comparison between Ned Irish and Jim Dolan, who currently owns the Knicks, I guess this is like sort of the one thing that really stuck with me was you had one point in the book where you said Eddie Donovan, who had led the Knicks to a 30% win percentage as head coach in the mid-60s, in about, I think it was two seasons, he said in a demonstration that Ned Irish's decision-making could occasionally defy logic, Donovan was rewarded with what appeared to be a promotion, moving up to the general manager's office while Harry Gallatin and soon after Dick McGuire took over the bench. And it reminded me so much of, like, in the mid-2000s when, you know, Dolan's relationship with Isaiah Thomas, where Isaiah just seemed to basically keep falling upward within the organization because he happened to be well-liked by Dolan. But I guess to, like, bring it to contemporary times, is the fact that the Knicks were able to succeed with an owner like Ned Irish kind of living proof that an eccentric and often even kind of destructive Knicks owner can still somehow find success? And then as sort of a follow-up, do you think maybe Dolan was just born in the wrong era? And, you know, maybe if in the modern day, if he was able to strong-arm being owner of the New York Knicks, you know, being in the big market with all the money, would he have been better suited maybe for that era where he could have just strong-armed the rest of the league rather than the current day where he has to navigate free agency and everybody's on a level playing field with a salary cap and all that stuff?
Well, it's funny and insightful on your part that that you mentioned that, because last summer the Times called me about an hour after Durant and Kyrie officially, you know, that Sunday night, which where free agency began, and the NBA did a brilliant thing, by the way, to move it from midnight. It was always, you know, July 1st midnight that they moved it to, like, whatever it was, 6 p.m.
Yeah.
And I thought that was, like, you know, a classic stroke of NBA brilliant marketing, because I called it in the Times called me after and said, hey, can you write, you know, mainly about the Knicks, but I called it, like, the NBA in its infinite wisdom created the Super Bowl of free agency. And when you think about it, Sunday, it was, you know, at least July 1st was going to fall on a Monday, so, you know, they had it begin on Sunday evening in the exact time slot that the Super Bowl is always held in, and it created must-see TV for like 3 hours or so, which is about 3.5 hours about the Super Bowl. I was attuned to the Jump with Rachel and Nichols and whoever else she had on. Brian Windhorst, I think, was on that. They had Woj reporting in from wherever he was. And it was just fascinating to watch it, you know, in a prime time Sunday night. Yeah, and I said, this is like fantastic. But the gist of my column the next day, I wrote it the following morning, was to say exactly that, that Jim Dolan was born in the wrong era, because his meddling and all the bad optics, whether you want to say it was the treatment of Carmelo, you know, that was really Phil precipitated, or the Oakley fiasco, or, you know, all the nonsense that's gone on in recent years, the coach firings, the, you know, the even going back to the meddling in the Carmelo deal, you know, when he usurped Donnie Walsh, and all the bad, you know, the dealing with fans and calling them drunks and, you know, all the bad stuff that creates such poor curb appeal. And so as it relates to how the Knicks are run, and how it impacts their ability to improve their team. Well, NBA stars are their own little cottage industries. I mean, they're going to get the same money no matter where they go. They're going to generate the kind of, you know, endorsement revenue no matter where they go. I mean, LeBron, when he was drafted by the Cavaliers, I remember his quote, you know, we're going to light it up like it's Vegas. And he did. You know, the story follows the superstars, so that, you know, the cameras are going to be wherever Zion Williamson is going to be. And so when they see all this craziness going on at the Garden, they say, you know, I don't need that. I mean, everybody talked for a full season pretty much that, of course, Durant's going to want to play at the Garden. It's the Garden. Mike Francesa was on, you know, are you kidding me? It's the Garden. You're going to compare it to Barclays Center? And I'm like, Durant's thinking, like, the party is wherever I go. I'm Kevin Durant. And so that's why, you know, these guys don't go to the Garden, because they think, all being equal, I don't want to deal with that maniac. I don't want to deal with it. And then you have, you know, people like Alan Hahn who go on the radio and say, Dolan doesn't interfere with the team anymore. He lets these guys do their thing. He's let, you know, Steve Mills and before that Phil do their thing. He only establishes media policies. Well, media policies go a long way in determining what the reputation of the franchise is. And the perfect example of it was last year when he forced Mills and Perry to walk into the press conference before Fizdale and make a complete, you know, fools of themselves. And everybody knew that Dolan had put them up to it. So the team was 2-8 at that point, I believe. I think it was after 10 games.
Yeah.
And from that moment on, Fizdale was a dead man. And the players knew it. And at the same time, you know, it also, you know, sent a message that the front office guys were also puppets. So, you know, once the players know that the coach is really, you know, we're just waiting for the for their head, his head to be chopped off, the players, you know, for all we want to see immediate improvement, they immediately lost 8 of the next 10 games, and that season, for the most part, was history. I, for one, actually thought that that team, and they're not a good team, but I thought that that team should have been more competitive. At least in a conference where there were so many bad teams, you can't convince me that that team couldn't have been, you know, if they felt like they really, the coach was really in charge, that team couldn't have been, you know, as good as Orlando, or at least instead of being 10 games out of a playoff spot, maybe 4 games out or something like that, to at least create the illusion of meaningful games coming down the stretch before the season was, you know, was shut down. But that was all attributable to Dolan undercutting his people and sending a terrible message to the players, so that, you know, there was a chaotic feel to the team, and another season goes down the drain. So you can't convince me that his media policies, if that's the only thing that he's involved in, it goes way beyond not including Stephen Bondi on a conference call. It sets the tone for how people perceive the team. And among those people are Kevin Durant and Kyrie Irving and other prospective free agents. So, you know, I do think, and so it's a long-winded story, but I do think that if you put Dolan in the 60s, when there was no free agency, and you could run a dictatorship, and like Red Auerbach, who was obviously a great coach and understood talent, but, you know, when a guy would come into Auerbach after averaging 18 points and grabbing 12 rebounds or whatever, and say, Red, you know, I made $12,000 this year. I really think I deserve 24. I think I should get my salary should be doubled. And Red would say, you know, I'll give you 15. And the guy would say, 15, only $3,000 raise. I averaged 18 and 12, whatever. We won the championship. Red would say, okay, fine. Would you like me to trade you to Cincinnati? The answer was no, because then he wouldn't get any playoff money at all. You know, they counted on that playoff money. So ultimately they would say, all right, you know, I'll take the 15 or 16 that you give me. And I know I'll make a few thousand more in the playoffs. The players had no leverage. Without leverage, lends itself to any kind of an owner, any kind of a dictatorship that the owner, you know, wants to create. And, you know, so a guy like Dolan could potentially succeed in a much easier way in that era than he could now, where the players are the ones with all the leverage. And given all the choices of the different markets, you know, let's face it, the Lakers were a dysfunctional team for several years, but not to the level of the Knicks for 20 years, nearly. So that when LeBron was, you know, deciding where to go after Cleveland the second time, you know, he thought, you know, I'll go to the Lakers, and that culture will change because a powerful player like myself has the ability to change it. Whereas I'm not so sure that even a guy like Durant thinks that going to New York could impact the owner enough so that he would mind his own business and let the franchise operate to its maximum capacity. And, you know.
Harvey, we're going to, I mean, you've been incredibly generous with your time, and we really appreciate it. I just wanted to send you out with one last question. I feel like this is a good, if maybe somewhat dour note to end on, but there was a quote in your book from Jim Trecker, the Garden's play-by-play typist, that said, people really took to the Knicks in the late 60s because they were such a pleasurable team to watch, but I think there's a strong possibility they wanted to feel psychologically connected because everything else was blowing up all around us, because it was a tough time to feel good about life in America. There was a yearning for togetherness, a sense of universal family. And I was just kind of wondering how that quote plays in your mind today, when we're in sort of an unprecedented national tragedy, at least in all of our lifetimes. And it's interesting, just, I mean, even being on social media now, the continued yearning and passion for sports. I mean, people were tuning in to watch NBA players and WNBA players play horse on grainy footage on people's phones on ESPN. And I know now we're doing these podcasts that are focusing on things that happened somewhere between 20 and 50 years ago. And I mean, they're some of the most listened to podcasts we're ever done, because people have this desire to, I guess, be a part of the unity that sports inherently brings. And I guess what's your perspective on how people are sort of grasping for it today when we don't have any actual games to talk about?
Yeah, well, let me slip in a shameless plug for my next
Please.
Book, which is due out in October. And the title of it is going to be Our Last Season. And the subtitle is A Sports Writer, A Fan, A Friendship. And it's about a 40-year friendship I had with a woman named Michelle Musler, who sat behind the Knicks bench for 45 years in that first row of season ticket holders. And she became an extraordinary woman who became a sort of a wise elder in my life and a confidant and mentor. In trying to understand, you know, why she spent so much money across the years investing in basketball and at the Garden. And understanding how, I remember when we were, she flew down to Houston for games 6 and 7 in 94. And I remember she waited up for me at the hotel after I finished my column. And we went and had a late night drink, and she was in a surprisingly good mood despite the fact that, you know, Starks had shot 2 for 18 and they'd come all this way and Jordan had stepped aside and they still couldn't pull it off. And her attitude was, you know, well, listen, they gave it their best. You know, Starks had a terrible night. I so enjoyed this season. And, I've just been making little last second tune-ups to the book and in trying to understand, you know, what makes a fan so committed. And, you know, we often talk about, you know, winning. And I think if anything that this experience, for those of us who love sports and the NBA in particular, will have taught us whenever it is that we come out of this, my dear friend Michelle figured out, the Garden kind of became, she was a divorced mother who raised 5 kids by herself and had some very tough years and sort of refound her social life through being a Knicks fan at the Garden and being so close to the court and getting to know a lot of the players and coaches and all the celebrity fans around her. The essence of it is not, I think the line that I put into the book was that it's ultimately about the journey, not the trophy. And I think that's something, you know, for those of us who, you know, at 7 o'clock find ourselves twitching, you know, moving toward the television.
Yeah.
But then thinking like, oh, there's no game. That's what we miss. We miss the continuity of it, you know, the connection. And we, you know, so even when we take measure of a guy like Patrick Ewing and we say, well, yeah, he never won the ring. In the end, big deal, right? I mean, he was part of it, you know, for the 90s, for a team that was so much fun to watch and built its own identity so far apart from, you know, the 70s teams of, you know, the right way and all that. They played bully ball and Riley ball and everything, but they were their own people and their own collective style. And you know what we wouldn't have to just have another decade like that in New York, where we have those great spring playoff nights. But even more than that, just to have something that we're emotionally connected to and that we can count on to distract us from the ordinary stressful things in life, like our jobs or family problems or illness. You know, now we're living through a catastrophe, right? So everything seems that much more anxiety producing. But I think when we get sports back, whenever that is, and whether it's, you know, whether we're at the arenas and ballparks or just watching on TV, we're going to just appreciate, you know, the athleticism, the entertainment, the distraction, and the continuity that it brings to our lives on a daily basis. But I think that is the essence of sports. And, you know, in that book that, you know, is coming out, which in some ways is a sequel to When the Garden Was Eden, because it covers the years, you know, when I was a reporter and not a fan. I think that's the takeaway from it, is how much we love it because it's a mainstay in our daily lives, and that's what we're lacking now.
No, I think that's incredibly well said, and I think I can speak for me and Alex in that we identify with a lot of that, and it's a real comfort to even be able to do this podcast and get just a sense of it. Harvey, and I want to encourage anyone as we kind of wrap up here who hasn't read When the Garden Is Eden to certainly do it. There are a lot of great details that even with as long as we went, we didn't get to cover, and it's genuinely one of my 2 or 3 favorite sports books ever. I'm looking forward to reading the new one as well. And I guess just before we send you out, anything else you have coming in terms of more immediate writing, or should people just look out for the book in October?
Yeah, the book's coming out in October, at least, although I suppose if the NBA season were to be resumed and finished up in August, I would imagine that next season will start around Christmas time. It's possible the book could be timed to more of the holidays, but right now it's supposed to be out in late October. But I just, you know, I think, you know, we're all, I probably will be writing something as we get closer to May 8th about the 70 season, hopefully in the Times. You know, for now, I'm like everyone else, just kind of trying to figure out, you know, day to day, you know, how we fit into this new abnormal, and you know, just hoping that everybody out there is safe and managing to stay sane. And I appreciate you guys giving me the opportunity to ramble on about a book and a team that was special to me.
Well, Harvey, let me speak. I think I can speak for Gavin and I when I say that we realistically could have probably gone for about 4 hours.
there are more questions on the dock.
So,
but dinner time, so dinner is approaching.
Yeah, exactly. But thank you so much for all the time you gave us. And we may even, just like you have a sequel book coming out or a spiritual sequel, we might do a sequel to this someday, because I would love to continue this discussion. And I feel like, despite being born well after the heyday of these teams, I could probably talk and listen about them forever. And I guess that's sort of the good part of being a Knicks fan, where your team hasn't won a title in almost 50 years, is that you're much more likely to spend some time appreciating the past and the teams that came well before the cruddy teams that you root for now. So, again, thank you on behalf of both of us so much for coming on and spending so much time. And I really hope and I'm positive that all the listeners are going to really appreciate the time as well.
It's my pleasure. And I have your email, so I will put you on the list to get a book sent to you when they send out the promotional copies.
Certainly cannot wait.
It's incredibly generous. Yeah. Thanks again, Harvey.
All right, guys. I enjoyed it.
All right, awesome. Have a good one, and stay safe, and same to all of your family, too.
All right, you too. Bye-bye.
All right, bye.
Thank you, Harvey. Bye-bye. All right, and that is all with our long-ranging interview with Harvey Aretan. I think we mentioned this on the first episode, but he gave us like 2.5 hours in reasonably would have given us more, it seemed like. It seemed like he was perfectly content to talk with us for 5-6 hours, had we so pleased. And maybe someday we will continue this discussion, Gavin. But I really enjoyed this interview, and you know, I would strongly encourage anybody that hasn't already to check out When the Garden Was Eden. You know, you can get it off Amazon, like on your Kindle, or you can get it paperback, or, you know, whatever. But it's a fantastic book, and, you know, really, a lot of the stuff that we discussed in these episodes was in that book, and, you know, that plus more, you know, tons of anecdotal stuff and great stories that Harvey told in that book. So I don't know about you. This is probably my favorite show that we've done so far.
Yeah, I mean, how lucky were we to have him and Chris Herring back to back and really get an in-depth look at these two teams? Because I know even just watching the 30 for 30, like you didn't get quite the level of detail, I think, even that we had in this podcast. And we were able to sort of take the best of what was in the 30 for 30. Some of the best stuff from the book, though, I'll say that book is just incredibly well written. And Alex, I mean, I remember in terms of your question of like, what was like the funniest moment from the book, like the little quote you read and the anecdote that he mentioned after that. Like there's so much of that in the book, like these little like conversations, just so funny. And it's kind of this beautiful thing once a player's been retired for 40 years, I guess just any older human being in general, but they just really, they don't give a crap at a certain point. And they're just really, really stark in their view of things. And just like, and it's even like some of the stuff about like Bill Bradley, like really struggling at initially in his career and like how that turned around. Like there's just so much good stuff in the book. So I know this podcast was great, and it was, I mean, thanks to the generosity of Harvey, exhaustive, but I'd still really, really encourage people to read the book, because as we note during the podcast and sort of in, not necessarily in contrast to the 90s teams, because as Chris kind of established, like even outside of like our Knicks, orange and blue colored glasses, The 90s Knicks were clearly important to the NBA landscape as a whole. The 70s Knicks, or the 69-70 Knicks, were essential to the NBA landscape. Like, I don't want to say they changed how basketball was played, because the old Celtics had a lot of the same elements in terms of their unselfishness, but in terms of being skilled at all five positions and having five guys who could shoot from the perimeter, pass and dribble at all five spots, that was relatively unique at that point in NBA history. And I know that's an argument that I make and Harvey makes throughout the podcast, but I do think, Alex, that more than anything else really makes them worth studying, worth appreciating. And I hope you guys felt that way listening to these four episodes.
Yeah, certainly. I loved all the topics that we got to get into with him. I was looking forward to asking a few of the questions that sort of went against the grain of the book. Getting a little more info in that second to last episode about how it was for him when he had to break that story about Willis Reed that, you know, eventually got Reed fired. Hearing more about his experience with Clyde, you know, in St. Croix, and sort of getting a look behind the mask there. And then just in general, him elaborating more on some of the stuff earlier in the episodes too, about, you know, the Cassie Russell and Willis Reed thing, like a little more info about that, and how he came to want to write the book, which was all kind of stemmed from that incident. Like, he wanted to elaborate more on that incident, which then made him want to write the whole book. And I don't know. I love this whole interview. I thought it was fantastic. And, I hope everybody reads the book too, just to get more of an idea for these teams, because they're really a fascinating group and a fascinating story to tell, everything from what happened on the court to the behind the scenes stuff, how these guys gelled, how a team that was really so diverse by, especially by late 60s, early 70s standards, managed to come together during a time of like real racial unrest in the country. It was pretty inspiring and crazy. And honestly, I think part of why New York gets the rep that it does is such a, culturally diverse melting pot. I think that the Knicks were sort of a microcosm of that in those, the early 70s and whatever, proving that, a really diverse team, can come together and respect each other and win at the highest level. And yeah, I don't know. I'm sort of rambling at this point, but I loved it. I came away with a way greater appreciation for these teams than I had previously.
Yeah, I think just like some of the individuals on this team, like just because they were sort of the epitome of team, get a little bit underrated. Like you look at someone like Bill Bradley, who was only like one of like maybe like the sixth or seventh most talented guys on one of these teams, and he's literally the only player in the history of professional basketball alongside Manu Ginobili to win a EuroLeague title, an Olympic gold, and an NBA title. You look at someone like Willis Reed, and we spent a lot of time on this on the podcast, but just the idea that like how genuinely good he was. And to that point, I mean, I feel like he doesn't get brought up all that. Like the conversation of like the greatest Knick is always Clyde or Patrick Ewing, but Reed is the only Knick to ever win an MVP award. It's just him. And I even mentioned this in the podcast, but there was a quote in the 30 for 30 for Marv Albert that he said, Willis Reed was the most competitive player I ever saw before Michael Jordan. So I thought that was pretty telling. Someone like Jerry Lucas, I think I noted this, but in high school, Alex, he was considered like the greatest high school player of all time, like maybe alongside Will Chamberlain, but he played in Ohio. It was just totally, totally dominant. So even someone, again, who was, I mean, by the time he was on the Knicks, like maybe their fifth best player, maybe their sixth best player, like just an absolute legend and a Hall of Famer. So I think because they were recognized as such a complete team, like you forget like, oh wait, these like six guys on the 72-73 team made the Hall of Fame, not counting Phil Jackson and Red Holtzman, and they deserved to make the Hall of Fame. It wasn't a situation like a Robert Horry who just like ended up on really good teams and hit big shots at the right time. Like they were all, with the possible exception of Bill Bradley, and I guess I think his is sort of more like the scope of his basketball career, like they were all genuinely good enough to be Hall of Fame players.
Yeah, certainly. And unless you had anything else to add, I think with a heavy heart, we can... Yeah. wrap up this final part of the Harvey Aretan interview. But certainly everyone listening, I hope you guys enjoyed this. We certainly enjoyed this on, I think, you know, getting this interview and then doing this interview, I think, on a different level than pretty much anyone that we've done so far, as evidenced by the fact that we went for a whole, like, 2.5 hours on it. But, yeah, if you listen to this episode and you didn't catch the first three parts, definitely make sure to go back and check those out. We titled them all When the Garden Was Eden. And then if you missed the retrospective with Chris Herring that Gavin mentioned about the 94 finals team, check those two episodes out. And if you missed our look back at the 99 finals team with Mark Berman, we have one episode on that as well. So definitely take a look back at all those. This is wrapping up, I think, my favorite series that we've done yet on Locked On Knicks, which was spurred on by a Locked On Wide initiative to take a look at the best teams, and we managed to pull out all the stops and I think take a really good look at all of the best teams in Knicks history that are pretty inarguably the best ones that ever set foot on the court for them. So hope you enjoyed this, and we'll be back with some more great stuff later this week. Peace out.